Chapter 3. Type I and Type X. Rochester, New York is an unlikely epicenter for a social earthquake. The companies that built this stolid city just 62 miles from the Canadian border were titans of the industrial economy. Eastman Kodak made film. Western Union delivered telegrams. Xerox produced photocopiers. And they piloted their enterprises by the precepts of Motivation 2.0. If you offer people steady employment and carefully calibrated rewards, they'll do what executives and shareholders want, and everyone will prosper. But starting in the 1970s, on the campus of the University of Rochester, a motivational revolution was brewing. It began in 1971, when Edward Deci, fresh from his Soma puzzle experiments, arrived on campus for a joint appointment in the psychology department and the business school. It intensified in 1973, when the business school unceremoniously booted Deci because of his heretical findings about rewards, and the psychology department hired him full-time. It gathered more steam in 1975, when Deci published a book called Intrinsic Motivation. And it launched in earnest in 1977, when a student named Richard Ryan showed up for graduate school. Ryan, a philosophy major in college, had just missed being drafted into the military. Nursing a bit of survivor's guilt, he'd been working with Vietnam War veterans suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And he'd come to the University of Rochester to learn how to become a better clinician. One day in a seminar, a professor brought up the subject of intrinsic motivation and then denounced it with table-pounding ferocity. "I figured that if there was that much resistance, this must be something interesting," Ryan told me. He picked up a copy of Deci's book, found it compelling, and asked its author to lunch. So commenced a remarkable research collaboration that continues to this day. When I met them not long ago in a blocky U of R office building, the two were a study in both contrast and similarity. Deci is tall and reedy, with a pale complexion and thin, wispy hair. He speaks in a quiet, soothing voice that reminded me of the late American children's television host, Mr. Rogers. Ryan, who has straight white hair parted down the middle, is ruddier and more intense. He presses his point like a skilled litigator. Deci, meanwhile, waits patiently for you to reach his point, then agrees with you and praises your insight. Deci is the classical music station on your FM dial. Ryan is more cable TV. And yet they talk to each other in a cryptic academic shorthand, their ideas smoothly in sync. The combination has been powerful enough to make them among the most influential behavioral scientists of their generation. Together, Deci and Ryan have fashioned what they call self-determination theory. Many theories of behavior pivot around a particular human tendency. We're keen responders to positive and negative reinforcements, or zippy calculators of our self-interest, or lumpy duffel bags of psychosexual conflicts. SDT, by contrast, begins with a notion of universal human needs. It argues that we have three innate psychological needs: competence, autonomy, and relatedness. When those needs are satisfied, we're motivated, productive, and happy. When they're thwarted, our motivation, productivity, and happiness plummet. If there's anything fundamental about our nature, it's the capacity for interest. Some things facilitate it, some things undermine it, Ryan explained during one of our conversations. Put another way, we've all got that third drive. It's part of what it means to be human. But whether that aspect of our humanity emerges in our lives depends on whether the conditions around us support it. And the main mechanisms of Motivation 2.0 are more stifling than supportive. "This is a really big thing in management," says Ryan. When people aren't producing, companies typically resort to rewards or punishment. What you haven't done is the hard work of diagnosing what the problem is. You're trying to run over the problem with a carrot or a stick, Ryan explains. That doesn't mean that SDT unequivocally opposes rewards. Of course, they're necessary in workplaces and other settings, says Deci. But the less salient they are made, the better. When people use rewards to motivate, that's when they're most demotivating. Instead, DC and Ryan say we should focus our efforts on creating environments for our innate psychological needs to flourish. Over the last 30 years, through both their scholarship and mentorship, DC and Ryan have established a network of several dozen SDT scholars conducting research in the United States, Canada, Israel, Singapore, and throughout Western Europe. These scientists have explored self-determination and intrinsic motivation in laboratory experiments and field studies that encompass just about every realm: business, education, medicine, sports, exercise, personal productivity, environmentalism, relationships, and physical and mental health. They have produced hundreds of research papers, most of which point to the same conclusion. Human beings have an innate inner drive to be autonomous, self-determined, and connected to one another. And when that drive is liberated, people achieve more and live richer lives. SDT is an important part of a broad swirl of new thinking about the human condition. This constellation includes, perhaps most prominently, the positive psychology movement, which has reoriented the study of psychological science away from its previous focus on malady and dysfunction and toward well-being and effective functioning. Under the leadership of the University of Pennsylvania's Martin Seligman, positive psychology has been minting legions of new scholars and leaving a deep imprint on how scientists, economists, therapists, and everyday people think about human behavior. One of positive psychology's most influential figures is Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, whom I mentioned earlier. Csikszentmihalyi's first book about flow and Seligman's first book on his theories, which argued that helplessness was learned rather than innate behavior, appeared in the same year as Deasy's book on intrinsic motivation. Clearly something big was in the air in 1975. It's just taken us a generation to reckon with it. This broad assortment of new thinkers includes Carol Dweck of Stanford University and Harvard's Amabile. It includes a few economists, most prominently Roland Benabou of Princeton University and Bruno Frey of the University of Zurich, who are applying some of these concepts to the dismal science. And it includes some scholars who don't study motivation per se, in particular Harvard University's Howard Gardner and Tufts University's Robert Sternberg, who have changed our view of intelligence and creativity and offered a brighter view of human potential. This collection of scholars, not in concert, not intentionally, and perhaps not even knowing they've been doing so, has been creating the foundation for a new, more effective operating system. At long last, the times may be catching up to their work. The power of the alphabet. Words matter, of course, but so do letters. Case in point, Meyer Friedman. You've probably never heard of him, but you almost certainly know his legacy. Friedman, who died in 2001 at the ripe old age of 90, was a cardiologist who for decades ran a bustling office in San Francisco. In the late 1950s, he and fellow physician Ray Rosenman began noticing similarities in their patients who were prone to heart disease. It wasn't only what these patients ate or what genes they inherited that affected their susceptibility to coronary trouble. It was also how they led their lives. These patients, Friedman noted, demonstrated a particular complex of personality traits, including excessive competition drive, aggressiveness, impatience, and a harrying sense of time urgency. Individuals displaying this pattern seem to be engaged in a chronic, ceaseless, and often fruitless struggle with themselves, with others, with circumstances, with time, sometimes with life itself. These people were significantly more likely to develop heart disease than other patients, even those who shared similar physical attributes, exercise regimens, diets, and family histories. Looking for a convenient and memorable way to explain this insight to their medical colleagues and the wider world, Friedman and Rosenman found inspiration in the alphabet. They dubbed this behavioral pattern Type A. Type A behavior stood in contrast to, naturally, Type B behavior. Unlike their horn-honking, foot-tapping counterparts who suffered from hurry sickness, people displaying type B behavior were rarely harried by life or made hostile by its demands. In their research, Friedman and Rosenman found that type B people were just as intelligent and frequently just as ambitious as type A's, but they wore their ambition differently. Writing about the type B person, and using the male-centered language common in the day, the cardiologist explained, "He may also have a considerable amount of drive, but its character is such that it seems to steady him, give confidence and security to him, rather than to goad, irritate, and infuriate, as with the type A man. One key to reducing deaths from heart disease and improving public health, therefore, was to help type A's learn to become a little more like type B's." 50 years later, this nomenclature remains. The two letters help us understand a complex web of behaviors and guide us toward a better and more effective way to live. Around the same time that Friedman and Rosenman were making their discovery, another American was pushing frontiers of his own. Douglas McGregor was a management professor at MIT who brought to the job an interesting combination of experiences. He'd earned a PhD from Harvard in psychology, rather than in economics or engineering, and in contrast to most of his colleagues, he'd actually run an institution. From 1948 to 1954, he was president of Antioch College. Drawing on his understanding of the human psyche, as well as his experience as a leader, McGregor began rethinking the conventions of modern management. He thought that the problem with corporate leadership wasn't so much its execution as its premises. Beginning with a speech in 1957, and later in a groundbreaking book called The Human Side of Enterprise in 1960, McGregor argued that those running companies were operating from faulty assumptions about human behavior. Most leaders believed that the people in their organizations fundamentally disliked work and would avoid it if they could. These faceless minions feared taking responsibility, craved security, and badly needed direction. As a result, most people must be coerced, controlled, directed, and threatened with punishment to get them to put forth adequate effort toward the achievement of organizational objectives. But McGregor said there was an alternative view of employees, one that offered a more accurate assessment of the human condition and a more effective starting point for running companies. This perspective held that taking an interest in work is as natural as play or rest, that creativity and ingenuity were widely distributed in the population, and that under the proper conditions, people will accept and even seek responsibility. To explain these contrasting outlooks, McGregor mined the back end of the alphabet. He called the first view Theory X, and the second Theory Y. If your starting point was Theory X, he said, your managerial techniques would inevitably produce limited results, or even go awry entirely. If you believed in the mediocrity of the masses, as he put it, then mediocrity became the ceiling on what you could achieve. But if your starting point was Theory Y, the possibilities were vast, not simply for the individual's potential, but for the company's bottom line as well. The way to make business organizations work better, therefore, was to shift management thinking away from Theory X and toward Theory Y. Once again, the nomenclature stuck, and McGregor's approach soon became a staple of management education. A picture may be worth a thousand words, but sometimes neither is as potent as just two letters. So, with a hoist from Meyer Friedman onto the shoulders of Douglas McGregor, I'd like to introduce my own alphabetic way to think about human motivation. Type I and Type X. The Motivation 2.0 operating system depended on and fostered what I call Type X behavior. Type X behavior is fueled more by extrinsic desires than intrinsic ones. It concerns itself less with the inherent satisfaction of an activity and more with the external rewards to which that activity leads. The Motivation 3.0 operating system, the upgrade that's needed to meet the new realities of how we organize, think about, and do what we do, depends on what I call Type I behavior. Type I behavior is fueled more by intrinsic desires than extrinsic ones. It concerns itself less with the external rewards to which an activity leads and more with the inherent satisfaction of the activity itself. At the center of type X behavior is the second drive. At the center of type I behavior is the third drive. If we want to strengthen our organizations, get beyond our decade of underachievement, and address the inchoate sense that something's gone wrong in our businesses, our lives, and our world, we need to move from type X to type I. I use these two letters largely to signify extrinsic and intrinsic, but also to pay homage to Douglas McGregor. To be sure, reducing human behavior to two categories sacrifices a certain amount of nuance. And nobody exhibits purely type X or type I behavior every waking minute of every living day without exception. But we do have certain, often very clear dispositions. You probably know what I mean. Think about yourself. Does what energizes you, what gets you up in the morning and propels you through the day, come from the inside or from the outside? What about your spouse, your partner, or your children? How about the men and women around you at work? If you're like most people I've talked to, you instantly have a sense into which category someone belongs. You can even try this with people you don't know. See if you agree. Enron's Jeff Skilling was type X. Berkshire Hathaway's Warren Buffett is type I. Antonio Salieri was type X. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was type I. The very wealthy Donald Trump is type X. The even wealthier Oprah Winfrey is type I. Former CEO of GE Jack Welch is type X. Interface Global founder Ray Anderson is type I. Simon Cowell is type X. Bruce Springsteen is type I. I don't mean to say that type X people always neglect the inherent enjoyment of what they do, or that type I people resist outside goodies of any kind. But for type X's, the main motivator is external rewards. Any deeper satisfaction is welcome, but secondary. For type I's, the main motivator is the freedom, challenge, and purpose of the undertaking itself. Any other gains are welcome, but mainly as a bonus. A few more distinctions to keep in mind before we go further. Type I behavior is made, not born. These behavioral patterns aren't fixed traits. They are proclivities that emerge from circumstance, experience, and context. Type I behavior, because it arises in part from universal human needs, does not depend on age, gender, or nationality. The science demonstrates that once people learn the fundamental practices and attitudes and can exercise them in supportive settings, their motivation and their ultimate performance soars. Any type X can become a type I. Type I's almost always outperform type X's in the long run. Intrinsically motivated people usually achieve more than their reward-seeking counterparts. Alas, that's not always true in the short term. An intense focus on extrinsic rewards can indeed deliver fast results. The trouble is, this approach is difficult to sustain, and it doesn't assist in mastery, which is the source of achievement over the long haul. The most successful people, the evidence shows, often aren't directly pursuing conventional notions of success. They're working hard and persisting through difficulties because of their internal desire to control their lives, learn about their world, and accomplish something that endures. Type I behavior does not disdain money or recognition. Both type X's and type I's care about money. If an employee's compensation doesn't hit the baseline that I described in Chapter 2, if her organization doesn't pay her an adequate amount, or if her pay isn't equitable compared to others doing similar work, that person's motivation will crater, regardless of whether she leans toward X or toward I. However, once compensation meets that level, money plays a different role for type I's than for type X's. Type I's don't turn down raises or refuse to cash paychecks, but one reason fair and adequate pay is so essential is that it takes the issue of money off the table so they can focus on the work itself. By contrast, for many type X's, money is the table. It's why they do what they do. Recognition is similar. Type I's like being recognized for their accomplishments because recognition is a form of feedback. But for them, unlike for Type X's, recognition is not a goal in itself. Type I behavior is a renewable resource. Think of Type X behavior as coal and Type I behavior as the sun. For most of recent history, coal has been the cheapest, easiest, and most efficient resource. But coal has two downsides. First, it produces nasty things like air pollution and greenhouse gases. Second, it's finite. Getting more of it becomes increasingly difficult and expensive each year. Type X behavior is similar. An emphasis on rewards and punishments spews its own externalities, as enumerated in Chapter 2. And if-then motivators always grow more expensive. But Type I behavior, which is built around intrinsic motivation, draws on resources that are easily replenished and inflict little damage. It is the motivational equivalent of clean energy, inexpensive, safe to use, and endlessly renewable. Type I behavior promotes greater physical and mental well-being. According to a raft of studies from SDT researchers, people oriented toward autonomy and intrinsic motivation have higher self-esteem, better interpersonal relationships, and greater general well-being than those who are extrinsically motivated. By contrast, people whose core aspirations are Type X validation such as money, fame, or beauty tend to have poorer psychological health. There's even a connection between Type X and Type A. Deci has found that those oriented toward control and extrinsic rewards show greater public self-consciousness, act more defensively, and are more likely to exhibit the Type A behavior pattern. Ultimately, Type I behavior depends on three nutrients: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Type I behavior is self-directed. It is devoted to becoming better and better at something that matters, and it connects the quest for excellence to a larger purpose. Some might dismiss notions like these as gooey and idealistic, but the science says otherwise. The science confirms that this sort of behavior is essential to being human, and that now, in a rapidly changing economy, it is also critical for professional, personal, and organizational success of any kind. So we have a choice. We can cling to a view of human motivation that is grounded more in old habits than in modern science, or we can listen to the research, drag our business and personal practices into the 21st century, and craft a new operating system to help ourselves, our companies, and our world work a little better. It won't be easy. It won't happen overnight. So let's get started. Part 2. The Three Elements. Chapter 4. Autonomy. I've seen the future, and it works. It works in around-the-clock bursts in Sydney, Australia. It works on guerrilla-style side projects in Mountain View, California. And it works whenever it damn well pleases in Charlottesville, Virginia. The reason why it works is because of how it works. On the edges of the economy, slowly but inexorably, old-fashioned ideas of management are giving way to a newfangled emphasis on self-direction. That's why a little past noon on a rainy Friday in Charlottesville, only a third of CEO Jeff Gunther's employees have shown up for work. But Gunther, entrepreneur, manager, capitalist, is neither worried nor annoyed. In fact, he's as calm and focused as a monk. Maybe that's because he didn't roll into the office himself until about an hour ago. Or maybe that's because he knows his crew isn't shirking. They're working, just on their own terms. At the beginning of the year, Gunther launched an experiment in autonomy at Medius, one of a trio of companies he runs. He turned the company, which creates computer software and hardware to help hospitals integrate their information systems, into a ROW, R-O-W-E, a results-only work environment. ROWs are the brainchild of Callie Ressler and Jody Thompson, two former human resources executives at the American retailer Best Buy. ROWs principles marry the common-sense pragmatism of Ben Franklin to the cage-rattling radicalism of Saul Alinsky. In a row workplace, people don't have schedules. They show up when they want. They don't have to be in the office at a certain time, or any time for that matter. They just have to get their work done. How they do it, when they do it, and where they do it is up to them. That appealed to Gunther, who's in his early 30s. Management isn't about walking around and seeing if people are in their offices, he told me. It's about creating conditions for people to do their best work. That's why he'd always tried to give employees a long leash. But as Metius expanded, and as Gunther began exploring new office space, he started wondering whether talented, grown-up employees doing sophisticated work needed a leash of any length. So at the company's holiday dinner in December 2008, he made an announcement. For the first 90 days of the new year, the entire 22-person operation would try an experiment. It would become a row. In the beginning, people didn't take to it, Gunther says. The office filled up around 9 a.m. and emptied out in the early evening just as before. A few staffers had come out of extremely controlling environments and weren't accustomed to this kind of leeway. At one employee's previous company, staff had to arrive each day by 8 a.m. If someone was late, even by a few minutes, the employee had to write an explanation for everyone else to read. But after a few weeks, most people found their groove. Productivity rose, stress declined. And although two employees struggled with the freedom and left, by the end of the test period, Gunther decided to go with Roe permanently. Some people outside of the company thought I was crazy, he says. They wondered, how can you know what your employees are doing if they're not here? But in his view, the team was accomplishing more under this new arrangement. One reason, they were focused on the work itself rather than on whether someone would call them a slacker for leaving at 3 p.m. to watch a daughter's soccer game. And since the bulk of his staff consists of software developers, designers, and others doing high-level creative work, that was essential. For them, it's all about craftsmanship, Gunther says, and they need a lot of autonomy. People still had specific goals they had to reach. For example, completing a project by a certain time or ringing up a particular number of sales. And if they needed help, Gunther was there to assist. But he decided against tying those goals to compensation. That creates a culture that says it's all about money and not enough about the work. Money, he believes, is only a threshold motivator. People must be paid well and be able to take care of their families, he says. But once a company meets this baseline, dollars and cents don't much affect performance and motivation. Indeed, Gunther thinks that in a row environment, employees are far less likely to jump to another job for a $10,000 or even $20,000 increase in salary. The freedom they have to do great work is more valuable and harder to match than a pay raise. And employees' spouses, partners, and families are among Roe's staunchest advocates. More companies will migrate to this as more business owners my age come up. My dad's generation views human beings as human resources. They're the 2x4s you need to build your house, he says. For me, it's a partnership between me and the employees. They're not resources. They're partners. And partners, like all of us, need to direct their own lives. Players or pawns? We forget sometimes that management does not emanate from nature. It's not like a tree or a river. It's like a television or a bicycle. It's something that humans invented. As the strategy guru Gary Hamel has observed, management is a technology. And like Motivation 2.0, it's a technology that has grown creaky. While some companies have oiled the gears a bit, and plenty more have paid lip service to the same, at its core, management hasn't changed much in 100 years. Its central ethic remains control. Its chief tools remain extrinsic motivators. That leaves it largely out of sync with the non-routine right-brain abilities on which many of the world's economies now depend. But could its most glaring weakness run deeper? Is management, as it's currently constituted, out of sync with human nature itself? The idea of management, that is management of people rather than management of, say, supply chains, is built on certain assumptions about the basic natures of those being managed. It presumes that to take action or move forward, we need a prod, that absent a reward or punishment, we'd remain happily and inertly in place. It also presumes that once people do get moving, they need direction, that without a firm and reliable guide, they'd wander. But is that really our fundamental nature? Or to use yet another computer metaphor, is that our default setting? When we enter the world, are we wired to be passive and inert? Or are we wired to be active and engaged? I'm convinced it's the latter, that our basic nature is to be curious and self-directed. And I say that not because I'm a dewy-eyed idealist, but because I've been around young children and because my wife and I have 3 kids of our own. Have you ever seen a 6-month-old or a 1-year-old who's not curious and self-directed? I haven't. That's how we are out of the box. If at age 14 or 43 we're passive and inert, that's not because it's our nature. It's because something flipped our default setting. That something could well be management. Not merely how bosses treat us at work, but also how the broader ethos has leached into schools, families, and many other aspects of our lives. Perhaps management isn't responding to our supposedly natural state of passive inertia. Perhaps management is one of the forces that's switching our default setting and producing that state. Now, that's not as insidious as it sounds. Submerging part of our nature in the name of economic survival can be a sensible move. My ancestors did it. So did yours. And there are times, even now, when we have no other choice. But today, economic accomplishment, not to mention personal fulfillment, more often swings on a different hinge. It depends not on keeping our nature submerged, but on allowing it to surface. It requires resisting the temptation to control people and instead doing everything we can to reawaken their deep-seated sense of autonomy. This innate capacity for self-direction is at the heart of Motivation 3.0 and Type I behavior. The fundamentally autonomous quality of human nature is central to self-determination theory. As I explained in the previous chapter, Deasy and Ryan cite autonomy as one of 3 basic human needs. And of the 3, it's the most important, the sun around which SDT's planets orbit. In the 1980s, as they progressed in their work, Deasy and Ryan moved away from categorizing behavior as either extrinsically motivated or intrinsically motivated to categorizing it as either controlled or autonomous. Autonomous motivation involves behaving with a full sense of volition and choice, they write, whereas controlled motivation involves behaving with the experience of pressure and demand towards specific outcomes that comes from forces perceived to be external to the self. Autonomy, as they see it, is different from independence. It's not the rugged, go-it-alone, rely-on-nobody individualism of the American cowboy. It means acting with choice, which means we can be both autonomous and happily interdependent with others. And while the idea of independence has national and political reverberations, autonomy appears to be a human concept rather than a Western one. Researchers have found a link between autonomy and overall well-being, not only in North America and Western Europe, but also in Russia, Turkey, and South Korea. Even in high-poverty, non-Western locales like Bangladesh, social scientists have found that autonomy is something that people seek and that improves their lives. A sense of autonomy has a powerful effect on individual performance and attitude. According to a cluster of recent behavioral science studies, autonomous motivation promotes greater conceptual understanding, better grades, enhanced persistence at school and in sporting activities, higher productivity, less burnout, and greater levels of psychological well-being. Those effects carry over to the workplace. In 2004, Deasy and Ryan, along with Paul Bard of Fordham University, carried out a study of workers at an American investment bank. The 3 researchers found greater job satisfaction among employees whose bosses offered autonomy support. These bosses saw issues from the employee's point of view, gave meaningful feedback and information, provided ample choice over what to do and how to do it, and encouraged employees to take on new projects. The resulting enhancement in job satisfaction, in turn, led to higher performance on the job. What's more, the benefits that autonomy confers on individuals extends to their organizations. For example, researchers at Cornell University studied 320 small businesses, half of which granted workers autonomy, the other half relying on top-down direction. The businesses that offered autonomy grew at 4 times the rate of the control-oriented firms and had 1/3 the turnover. Yet too many businesses remain woefully behind the science. Most 21st century notions of management presume that in the end, people are pawns rather than players. British economist Francis Green, to cite just one example, points to the lack of individual discretion at work as the main explanation for declining productivity and job satisfaction in the UK. Management still revolves largely around supervision, if-then rewards, and other forms of control. That's true even of the kinder, gentler Motivation 2.1 approach that whispers sweetly about things like empowerment and flexibility. Indeed, just consider the very notion of empowerment. It presumes that the organization has the power and benevolently ladles some of it into the waiting bowls of grateful employees. But that's not autonomy. That's just a slightly more civilized form of control. Or take management's embrace of flex time. Ressler and Thompson call it a con game, and they're right. Flexibility simply widens the fences and occasionally opens the gates. It, too, is little more than control in sheep's clothing. The words themselves reflect presumptions that run against both the texture of the times and the nature of the human condition. In short, management isn't the solution, it's the problem. Perhaps it's time to toss the very word management onto the linguistic ash heap alongside icebox and horseless carriage. This era doesn't call for better management. It calls for a renaissance of self-direction. The Four Essentials. In 2002, Scott Farquhar and Mike Cannon Brooks, two wet-behind-the-ears Australians just out of university, borrowed $10,000 on their credit cards to start a software company. They anointed their venture with a bold name, Atlassian, after the Greek titan Atlas, who bore the world on his shoulders. And they set about creating a company to compete against some of the big names in enterprise software. At the time, their venture seemed loony. Today, it seems inspired. Through its combination of great computer code and smart business practices, Atlassian now rakes in about $35 million per year and employs nearly 200 people in offices in Sydney, Amsterdam, and San Francisco. But like any good entrepreneur, Cannon Brooks walks through life beneath a cloud of perpetual dissatisfaction. He'd seen successful companies stagnate and wished to avoid that fate for his. So, to spark even greater creativity among his team, and to make sure Atlassian's programmers were having fun at work, he decided to encourage them to spend a day working on any problem they wanted, even if it wasn't part of their regular job. This offbeat off-day gave birth to several ideas for new products and plenty of repairs and patches on existing ones. So Cannon Brooks decided to make the practice a permanent part of the Atlassian culture. Now, once a quarter, the company sets aside an entire day when its engineers can work on any software problem they want. Only this time, to get them out of the day-to-day, it must be something that's not part of their regular job. At 2 p.m. on a Thursday, the day begins. Engineers, including Cannon Brooks himself, crash out new code or an elegant hack any way they want, with anyone they want. Many work through the night. Then at 4 p.m. on Friday, they show the results to the rest of the company in a wild and woolly all-hands meeting stocked with ample quantities of cold beer and chocolate cake. Atlassian calls these 24-hour bursts of freedom and creativity FedEx days, because people have to deliver something overnight. And deliver Atlassians have. Over the years, this odd little exercise has produced an array of software fixes that might otherwise never have emerged. Says one engineer, some of the coolest stuff we have in our product today has come from FedEx days. This isn't a pay-for-performance plan grounded in the mechanistic assumptions of Motivation 2.0. It's an autonomy plan, nicely tuned to the alternate strains of Motivation 3.0. We've always taken the position that money is only something you can lose on, Ken and Brooks told me. If you don't pay enough, you can lose people. But beyond that, money is not a motivator. What matters are these other features. And what a few future-facing businesses are discovering is that one of these essential features is autonomy. In particular, autonomy over four aspects of work. What people do, when they do it, how they do it, and whom they do it with. As Atlassian's experience shows, type I behavior emerges when people have autonomy over the four T's: their task, their time, their technique, and their team. Task. Ken and Brooks was still dissatisfied. FedEx days were working fine, but they had an inherent weakness. You built something in 24 hours, but you didn't get any more time to work on it, he says. So he and co-founder Farquhar decided to double down their bet on employee autonomy. In the spring of 2008, they announced that for the next 6 months, Atlassian's developers could spend 20% of their time, rather than just one intense day, working on any project they wanted. As Ken and Brooks explained in a blog post to employees, a startup engineer must be all things. He or she is a full-time software developer and a part-time product manager, customer support guru, internal systems maven. As a company grows, an engineer spends less time building the things he personally wants in the product. Our hope is that 20% time gives engineers back dedicated stack time of their own direction to spend on product innovation, features, plugins, fixes, or additions that they think are the most important. This practice has a sturdy tradition and a well-known modern expression. Its pioneer was the American company 3M. In the 1930s and 1940s, 3M's president was William McKnight, a fellow who was as unassuming in his manner as he was visionary in his thinking. McKnight believed in a simple and at the time subversive credo: hire good people and leave them alone. Well before it was fashionable for managers to flap on about empowerment, he made a more vigorous case for autonomy. Those men and women to whom we delegate authority and responsibility, if they are good people, are going to want to do their jobs in their own way, he wrote in 1948. McKnight even encouraged employees to engage in what he called experimental doodling. With these unorthodox ideas percolating in his mind, this unlikely corporate heretic established a new policy. 3M's technical staff could spend up to 15% of their time on projects of their choosing. The initiative felt so counter to the mores of Motivation 2.0, so seemingly illicit, that inside the company, it was known as the bootlegging policy. And yet it worked. These walled gardens of autonomy soon became fertile fields for a harvest of innovations, including Post-it notes. Scientist Art Fry came up with his idea for the ubiquitous sticky, not in one of his regular assignments, but during his 15% time. Today, Post-its are a monumental business. 3M offers more than 600 Post-it products in more than 100 countries. And their cultural impact might be even greater. Consider, but for McKnight's early push for autonomy, we'd be living in a world without any small yellow squares stuck to our computer monitors. A chilling thought indeed. According to 3M's former head of research and development, most of the inventions that the company relies on even today emerged from those periods of bootlegging and experimental doodling. McKnight's innovation remains in place at 3M, but only a surprisingly small number of other companies have moved in this direction, despite its proven results. The best-known company to embrace it is Google, which has long encouraged engineers to spend one day a week working on a side project. Some Googlers use their 20% time to fix an existing product, but most use it to develop something entirely new. Of course, Google doesn't sign away the intellectual property rights to what's created during that 20%, which is wise. In a typical year, more than half of Google's new offerings are birthed during this period of pure autonomy. For example, scientist Krishna Bharat, frustrated by how difficult it was to find news stories online, created Google News in his 20% time. The site now receives millions of visitors every day. Former Google engineer Paul Buckeit created Gmail, now one of the world's most popular email programs, as his 20% project. Many other Google products share similar creation stories, among them Orkut, Google's social networking software, Google Talk, its instant messaging application, Google Sky, which allows astronomically inclined users to browse pictures of the universe, and Google Translate, its translation software for mobile devices. As Google engineer Alec Proudfoot, whose own 20% project aimed at boosting the efficiency of hybrid cars, put it in a television interview, just about all the good ideas here at Google have bubbled up from 20% time. Back at Atlassian, the experiment in 20% time seemed to work. In what turned out to be a year-long trial, developers launched 48 new projects. So, in 2009, Ken and Brooks decided to make this dose of task autonomy a permanent feature of Atlassian work life. The decision didn't sit well with everyone. By Ken and Brooks' back-of-the-blog calculations, 70 engineers spending 20% of their time over just a six-month period amounted to an investment of $1 million. The company's chief financial officer was aghast. Some project managers, despite Atlassian's forward-thinking ways the company still uses the M-word, weren't happy because it meant ceding some of their control over employees. When a few wanted to track employees' time to make sure they didn't abuse the privilege, Ken and Brooks said no. That was too controlling. I wanted to back our engineers and take it on faith that they'll do good things. Besides, he says, people are way more efficient about 20% time than regular work time. They say, I'm not going to do anything like read news feeds or do Facebook. These days, when a finance guy, pearls of sweat rolling from his green eye shades, objects to the price tag, Ken and Brooks has a ready response. I show him the long list of things we've delivered. I show him that we have zero turnover in engineering. And I show him that we have highly motivated engineers who are always trying to perfect and improve our product. Autonomy over task is one of the essential aspects of the Motivation 3.0 approach to work. And it isn't reserved only for technology companies. At Georgetown University Hospital in Washington, D.C., for instance, many nurses have the freedom to conduct their own research projects, which in turn have changed a number of hospital programs and policies. Autonomy measures can work in a range of fields and offer a promising source for innovations and even institutional reforms. Initiatives like FedEx Days and sanctioned side projects aren't always easy to execute in the day-to-day maw of serving customers, shipping products, and solving problems. But they're becoming urgent in an economy that demands non-routine, creative, conceptual abilities, as any artist or designer would agree. Autonomy over task has long been critical to their ability to create. And good leaders, as opposed to competent managers, understand this in their bones. Case in point, George Nelson, who was the design director at Herman Miller, the iconic American furniture maker for a few decades. He once laid down five simple tenets that he believed led to great design. One of these principles could serve as a rallying cry for Type I's ethic of autonomy over task. You decide what you will make. Time. Ever wonder why lawyers as a group are so miserable? Some social scientists have, and they've offered three explanations. One involves pessimism. Being pessimistic is almost always a recipe for low levels of what psychologists call subjective well-being. It's also a detriment in most professions. But as Martin Seligman has written, there is one glaring exception. Pessimists do better at law. In other words, an attitude that makes someone less happy as a human being actually makes her more effective as a lawyer. A second reason. Most other enterprises are positive sum. If I sell you something you want and enjoy, we're both better off. Law, by contrast, is often, though not always, a zero-sum game. Because somebody wins, somebody else must lose. But the third reason might offer the best explanation of all and help us understand why so few attorneys exemplify type I behavior. Lawyers often face intense demands but have relatively little decision latitude. Behavioral scientists use this term to describe the choices and perceived choices a person has. In a sense, it's another way of describing autonomy. And lawyers are glum and cranky because they don't have much of it. The deprivation starts early. A 2007 study of two American law schools found that over the three-year period in school, students' overall well-being plummeted, in large part because their need for autonomy was thwarted. But students who had greater autonomy over their course selection, their assignments, and their relations with professors showed far less steep declines and actually posted better grades and bar exam scores. Alas, at the heart of private legal practice is perhaps the most autonomy-crushing mechanism imaginable: the billable hour. Most lawyers, and nearly all lawyers in large prestigious firms, must keep scrupulous track, often in 6-minute increments, of their time. If they fail to bill enough hours, their jobs are in jeopardy. As a result, their focus inevitably veers from the output of their work, solving a client's problem, to its input, piling up as many hours as possible. If the rewards come from time, then time is what firms will get. These sorts of high-stakes, measurable goals can drain intrinsic motivation, sap individual initiative, and even encourage unethical behavior. If one is expected to bill more than 2,000 hours per year, former U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist once said, there are bound to be temptations to exaggerate the hours actually put in. The billable hour is a relic of Motivation 2.0. It makes some sense for routine tasks, whether fitting doors onto the body of a Ford Taurus or adding up deductions on a simple tax form, because there's a tight connection between how much time goes in and how much work goes out. And if your starting assumption is that workers' default setting is to shirk, monitoring their time can keep them on their toes. But the billable hour has little place in Motivation 3.0. For non-routine tasks, including law, the link between how much time somebody spends and what that somebody produces is irregular and unpredictable. Imagine requiring inventor Dean Kamen or actress Helen Mirren to bill for their time. If we begin from an alternative and more accurate presumption that people want to do good work, then we ought to let them focus on the work itself rather than the time it takes them to do it. Already a few law firms are moving in this new, more type I direction, charging a flat rate rather than a time-based fee, with the presiding partner of one of New York's leading law firms recently declaring, "This is the time to get rid of the billable hour." If the billable hour has an antithesis, it's the results-only work environment of the kind that Jeff Gunther has introduced at his companies. The first large company to go row was Best Buy, not in its stores, but in its corporate offices. Like 3M's 15% time, Best Buy's row experiment began as something of a rogue project launched by Ressler and Thompson, whom I mentioned earlier, and who have since become row gurus, taking their message of autonomy around the world. Best Buy's headquarters in Richfield, Minnesota are airy, modern, and replete with a concierge, cafes, and dry cleaner. But the company had a reputation for punishing hours and intrusive bosses, and it was paying the price in lost talent. Best Buy's then CEO Brad Anderson quietly agreed to Ressler and Thompson's weird proposal because it encouraged people to contribute rather than just show up and grind out their days. Today, Best Buy's headquarters has fewer people working a regular schedule than it has those working a row unscheduled. And even though retail electronics is a brutally competitive industry, Best Buy has held its own both in the marketplace and in its quest for talent. Reporting on the company's row results in the Harvard Business Review, Tamara Erickson writes, "Salaried people put in as much time as it takes to do their work. Hourly employees in the program work a set number of hours to comply with federal labor regulations, but they get to choose when. Those employees report better relationships with family and friends, more company loyalty, and more focus and energy. Productivity has increased by 35%. Involuntary turnover is 320 basis points lower than in teams that have not made the change. Employees say they don't know whether they work fewer hours. They've stopped counting. Without sovereignty over our time, it's nearly impossible to have autonomy over our lives. A few Type I organizations have begun to recognize this truth about the human condition and to realign their practices. More, no doubt, will follow. In the past, work was defined primarily by putting in time and secondarily on getting results. We need to flip that model," Ressler told me. "No matter what kind of business you're in, it's time to throw away the tardy slips, time clocks, and outdated industrial age thinking. Technique. When you call a customer service line to complain about your cable television bill or to check the whereabouts of that blender you ordered, the phone usually rings in a colorless cavern known as a call center. The person who answers the call, a customer service representative, has a tough job. He typically sits for hours among a warren of cramped cubicles, headset strapped on, a diet soda by his side. The pay is paltry, and the people the rep encounters on the phone, one after another, generally aren't ringing up to offer kudos or to ask about the rep's weekend plans. They've got a gripe, a frustration, or a problem that needs solving right now. If that weren't enough, call center reps have little decision latitude, and their jobs are often the very definition of routine. When a call comes in, they listen to the caller, and then in most cases, tap a few buttons on their computer to retrieve a script. Then they follow that script, sometimes word for word, in the hope of getting the caller off the line as quickly as possible. It can be deadening work, made drearier still because managers in many call centers, in an effort to boost productivity, listen in on reps' conversations and monitor how long each call lasts. Little wonder, then, that call centers in the United States and the UK have annual turnover rates that average about 35%, double the rate for other jobs. In some call centers, the annual turnover rate exceeds 100%, meaning that, on average, none of the people working there today will be there a year from now. Tony Hsieh, founder of the online shoe retailer Zappos.com, now part of Amazon.com, thought there was a better way to recruit, prepare, and challenge such employees. So new hires at Zappos go through a week of training. Then, at the end of those 7 days, Hsieh makes them an offer. If they feel Zappos isn't for them and want to leave, he'll pay them $2,000.